We are talking today with Paul Loeb. He is a local writer and author. He has been on our show several times in the past, and he is here today to discuss his new book, The Impossible Will Take a Little While, A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear. And you can find out more about the book at its website, www.theimpossible.org. Paul, thanks for spending time with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Perhaps you can tell us, what was the motivation for writing your new book, The Impossible Will Take a Little While?
Well, what's interesting is I do a lot of traveling around the country to lecture. I'm basically speaking, I think I spoke in the last 2 years, probably in 30 different states. And what I was coming up against was just this incredible despair. People, particularly among, well, two groups, among people who'd just gotten involved politically, particularly around the anti-war movement, and then also among people who've been active for a very long time. And they were just feeling so bleak at everything that Bush has done to this country and at the holes we've dug ourselves into and all the deeper currents. And they were just feeling like you try, none of it does any good, and maybe it just isn't worth it. And I was thinking, gee, this is terrible, because it is worth it and you have to keep on. And there were certainly some hopeful signs that I saw in the culture, particularly, again, the numbers of people, for instance, and the breadth of people who've come into the peace movement in the last couple of years and into just the different citizens' movements responding to Bush. And so I thought, God, I don't want to see these people burning out. I want to see them in it for the long haul, because if the old people can stick and if the new people can come in, we've got a very powerful base for change that's actually larger than what we've had in a long, long time. And so I thought, how do I, as a writer, how do I respond to this situation? And one of the things I thought I would do is to say, okay, let me do a book on political hope and persistence. And it's actually an idea that I had kicked around about 5 or 6 years ago before my Soul of a Citizen book, and thought about it, put it on the shelf, and now it just seemed like a good time to come back to it. And so I was really responding to a very, very strong felt need by saying, okay, let me ask the question, what gives me hope? How do I keep going? And what are the stories that inspire me? And maybe I can put them together in one place, and then there'll be a resource that'll be very useful for other people. And I also should say that even though, for instance, now the polls look pretty decent on getting rid of King George W., still I'm hitting the despair, because people are still feeling he'll steal it, he'll pull Osama bin Laden out of a hat, there'll be a fake terror alert or a succession of them, something will happen and it'll all collapse, even if it looks like we're going to get rid of him. And then, of course, even if Kerry gets in, we're certainly inheriting lots of problems and certain resistance to change. So I think the issues remain very, very current. That's a sense I get from people just who've seen the book in early drafts of it and said, my God, I need this now. I'm so grateful for this.
Now, how did you select and choose the pieces that make up your book?
Well, what I ended up doing in The Impossible Will Take a Little While, all four of my earlier books, Soul of a Citizen, Hope in Hard Times, Nuclear Culture, Generation of the Crossroads, all of them are just regular books written by me. Here I did something a little bit different, which is to say, who are my favorite authors who inspire me? And so I went to, well, I did a couple of different things, and they kind of, I think they came together in a really interesting way. I went, of course, to my bookshelves, and I just thought, you know, which are the books that just I pick up time and time and time again when I'm feeling down? So you have to have Vaclav Havel in there, and you have to have Nelson Mandela, and you have to have Desmond Tutu and Jonathan Kozol, and just some other just writers who really, really inspired me. And so I looked at those books, and I said, what are the sections that really resonate in my memory, you know, sometimes years after reading them? And if they resonate in my memory and give me hope, they'll probably do the same for other people. And so I carved out and adapted and rewrote. I mean, like with Alice Walker, I literally stitched together two pieces from 20 years apart, modified some language and sent it to her assistant and said, you know, is this okay? Kind of holding my breath. And her assistant's extremely, who I've known for a while, is extremely nice, and Alice is nice. And they said, yes, absolutely, and we'll call the publisher and waive our share of the fee. And, you know, they couldn't have been nicer. But, you know, it's a little bit nervous-making when you do something like that. And I, as I was doing it, I was thinking, you know, I probably couldn't have done this book when I was 23 years old because I wouldn't have had the sort of guts or whatever to just, you know, go up to the writers I most admire and say, oh, by the way, I'm revising a lot of your work, but is that okay? You know, so I did this walker and I worked it out with Howard Zinn to stitch together three different essays, two of which he'd suggested, one of which I'd found, and we wrote some new sentences together, and it was a lot of collaborative work. But obviously the ideas of these people and basically the words of these people who, again, I just most admire in the world. So that was one of the threads that fed into the impossible to take a little while. The other thread was that I, of course, commissioned some pieces, and there was like Marion Wright Edelman wrote a fresh piece for the book, and so just some wonderful writers wrote things according to Tony Kushner wrote something, just good folks. So I've got some new pieces in there. And then the other thing that happened is I have a 10,000 male email list. And actually, if you go to the impossible.org website, you can click and add yourself to the list. And I just put out the call and I said, well, what inspires you? You know, which authors are your favorite? Which essays are your favorite? And of course, a lot of it overlapped with ones I was already using. But I also got stuff completely out of the blue. So, for instance, there's a wonderful writer. She was a grad student in Indiana who was dealing with this. It's sort of like muscular dystrophy. It's a paralyzing, physically paralyzing disease where at a certain point she literally is sort of can do nothing but crawl. And it just comes over her periodically. And she was at a political meeting and heard somebody talk about, oh, I just feel so paralyzed. And she went through the roof. She said, like, you know, excuse me, I am paralyzed some of the time. And there's still things I can do, and I still do them. And let's have a sense of context. And she just wrote this just brilliant piece, I don't know any other way to describe it, about political engagement and physical paralysis and, you know, mental paralysis and how they intersected and getting beyond it. And it was just brilliant. And so that came in just cold. There was a wonderful minister, a Unitarian minister from Minneapolis, who once somebody in her congregation said, you got to go check out this woman's website. Her sermons are just, you know, knock people out. And he was right. It was just, again, in this case, I stitched a couple of them together. And just brilliant, visionary talking about how you live with courage in a time which really intimidates that. So I kind of like the mix in The Impossible of pieces that were very, very deliberate in terms of my coming up with them, and pieces that are just accidental. I mean, there was even a guy who was a Boeing worker from Everett who was he was on my list from some kind of peace activism or something, and his wife is from Zambia, and he sent in this just amazing short little piece about their nonviolent revolution against colonialism, how essentially the law was that you could, how to describe it, if you were black, you couldn't go into a store. You basically had to take your goods out through the window of a store. There were sort of limits on how you could buy it. And so this guy bought a Land Rover and demanded to take it out the window. And they said, no. I mean, of course, you could drive it out the gate. He says, nope, this is the law. We're going to follow the law. And he drives his Land Rover out through the wall and the window. And that sets off this nonviolent revolution at other points, the British, I guess, were attaché or ambassador, whatever he was, the guy who was in charge of everything, flew in to sort of put down order. And they organized the sort of, one woman organized the sort of the largest group of physically huge African women that you could find naked to greet him at the airport. And he just turned around and he went back. And so I would never have known that if I hadn't put out the word, but it's a very hopeful story about just the power of humans to act. So there was a certain kind of sort of random rolling the dice chance in this, and then just really being meticulous that every single essay sang and was powerful and added something to the book and didn't just repeat itself.
So the subtitle of the book, A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear, seems to indicate that you believe we are currently living in a time of fear.
We're living in a time of fear in a number of ways, and it's hard to untangle. I mean, there's certainly the manipulated fear created by the Bush administration. I mean, level orange, level pink, level green, level whatever the heck it is this week. I mean, I really do believe that every time the Democrats go up in the poll, there's some new announcement, there's some new terror alerts. And this is nothing new. I mean, I remember, you know, go back to the Reagan eras and, you know, the day, week before the election, they found something in Nicaragua that turned out, of course, not to exist, and found something in Cuba and Libya. And, I mean, they've been doing this game for a long time. Unfortunately, it has more resonance when, in fact, there are real people out there who I would argue that their numbers have been vastly increased by the administration's insanity in Iraq, who, in fact, would very much like to kill a whole bunch of Americans again to make a statement. And so it's hard because you have the real fear intertwining with the manipulated fear, and that's part of the ground of our time, is that kind of very dangerous mix, because you can't always say the latest alert is fraudulent because maybe it isn't. On the other hand, you can go look back and look back at the track record of the people who are giving you the alerts, and you can say that there's a pattern of lies. And I remember when there's my favorite Vietnam era poem by Robert Bly is called The Teeth Mother Naked at Last. And there's a line in it where he says, the president lies about the population of Kansas and the weight of the adult eagle and the time that the sun rises and the time that the sun sets. And, you know, it's about a culture where everything they say is a lie. And this is very much the culture that we've been dealing with. And so it's hard to know on the lines of the fear, just in terms of things like the terrorist attacks, whether they're real and when they're not. And then you layer over that the real fear of people with jobs disappearing and that their livelihoods are just slipping away as a result of policy choices. And, you know, will they be able to feed their family? Will they be able to get health care? Will they be able to send their kids to college? Is there a future in the economy? Will they be able to retire? All those levels of fear. You look at the very real, what we're doing to the environment and the, I mean, as you know, sitting through what feels to me like perhaps the hottest sun. I think it may be the hottest summer in Seattle ever. I mean, it certainly has hit record points at a number. And, you know, you look at Europe where it's the 10 hottest years are the last decade and 36,000 people died last year in European heat waves. I mean, those are, you know, there's a serious cause for fear in a sense of what we're doing to the planet. And then there's, my God, there's the fear of what happens if George Bush gets reelected. I mean, that's huge. So I think that the fear works on, and works isn't quite the right word, but is a presence on multiple levels, from the manipulated to the genuinely real causes for concern. And so then the question is, how do you end up coming out of that with a sense of hope and a sense of power to build an ability to be able to act and not just succumb to watching the bad news unfold? Which is, of course, what our culture encourages us to do.
And hopefully you'll share some of those insights with us here in
Absolutely.
The next hour. In your introduction in the book, you talk about our culture as being, quote, a culture that rewards cynicism, end quote. Can you give us some examples of that?
Well, I think that we're certainly encouraged to disdain social movements and to disdain the possibility of citizens acting. And so I go around, and I speak a lot of colleges, but it's not just colleges. It's, you know, everyone gets told in one way or another, subtly or not so subtly, you really don't have a voice. Your voice is not going to matter. Nothing you do is going to make a difference. And nothing you do is going to create change. And so we're systematically convinced, and I certainly, the last book of mine, Soul of a Citizen, the subtitle was Living with Conviction in a Cynical Time. We're certainly convinced that what we do won't matter. And we're taught it in different ways. We're taught it in part by, I would argue, by not knowing the stories of people who have made change, or where we do know them, they're sort of exceptionalized. I mean, I talked about it a little bit in Soul of a Citizen. I revisit here the Rosa Parks story, and it's very interesting how little we know, because I can go to any 7th grade class and everyone thinks they know the name of Rosa Parks and the story, and yet what they don't know is they think that she literally just one day stepped on a bus, refused to move to the back of the bus because her feet were tired, just acted completely alone, unconsciously. History instantly changed. There's no sense that she was acting. At that point, she'd been a civil rights activist with the NAACP for 12 years. First got involved in issues like lynching. I mean, a very dark, bleak chapter in our history of, you know, I would call that a form of terrorism, certainly. And we don't know that. We don't know that she went to training sessions at Highlander School the summer before her arrest. We don't know that that the reason that movement succeeded was in part because there was this very organized group of people who responded, and she was part of that group. So it doesn't take anything away from Rosa Parks, but it does say that if we want to see individual action as maybe occasionally possible only by the saints, then that's not going to help us. if we see Parks as an ordinary person working with other very ordinary people, I mean, the head of the local was a sleeping car porter who took people's suitcases on the trains. Now, A.F.L. Randolph had fought to organize that, so he was a union organizer as well. But he certainly wasn't anybody, this guy named E.D. Nixon, of position or power or standing. And this was what most of the people who participated in the movement, they were cleaning houses in other people's homes. I mean, they were not people of ostensible power. And so I think part of what happens is that when we're denied our history, and the history of how social change movements actually occurred, we don't think of the power that we have. We also don't think of the power we have even when things seem not to be going our way. So, for example, I go back to Parks and I say, well, there were those 12 years where it didn't look like a lot of progress was getting made. But one of the things that happened is that people like Parks were coming into a movement, and later on, something would turn. So I think, well, who brought Parks in? Well, I do know that it was her husband, Raymond Parks, who'd been active before that. But I don't actually know who got Raymond Parks involved. There may be some book on it that I haven't read, but nothing that I've read has had that. And so the interesting thing is that somebody who's completely unknown to history, or at least to most of us, took an action at a point when it looked like there was nothing going on and no motion was occurring, and got this person named Raymond Parks involved, and his wife would later on be the person that we all know. So I think of that in the current context, and I think of, for instance, again, to go back to the peace movement. I mean, there were, however you want to define the boundaries of it, several million people who participated, certainly, maybe 4 million, 5 million, 6 million, whatever it was in the United States, and, you know, tens of millions more globally. And a lot of them were new or were people who had lapsed from 25, 30 years ago. And so the question is, if those people continue to act, what will they do? What powerful things will they create? And only by viewing history in that way do we allow ourselves to really take the real merited hope that occurs whenever you bring somebody new into involvement, because you just don't know. I mean, they may not become the next Rosa Parks, because there are few people at that pinnacle, but you really don't know what they're going to do. And if you bring enough people in and they keep them going, some very powerful things will happen. I mean, that's sort of the title of the book, The Impossible Will Take a Little While, came from a Billie Holiday song, which is, the phrase is, the difficult I'll do it once, the impossible will take a little while. It's also actually the motto of the Army Corps of Engineers during World War II, which I was a little dubious at first, but then I thought, that's actually okay, because they were really on the right side. And, hey, those folks who are making those bridges and pontoon bridges to defeat Hitler, that's good. I admire that. That's courage. So it's okay to put them together with Billie Holiday. And I look at that, and what that says is, sure, you're working on a difficult task, but what you actually may be doing is also laying the groundwork for changing something that seems absolutely impossible at present.
Yeah, and creating that invisible web that so many times when we're, you know, kicking ourselves saying, oh, what is the point of getting up and going to another one of these things or doing this? I don't just see the results.
And exactly, and part of the dilemma is that the results are never totally clear. So sometimes we have measurable, apparent results. We win an election. We lose an election. We win a campaign. We lose a campaign. And those seem very tangible, and they are, and they're immensely consequential. I mean, in no way am I suggesting that you sort of throw away the importance of a critical time. I mean, something like this, you know, you want to defeat George Bush, you want to, you know, not make a symbolic statement for Ralph Nader or something like that. I mean, you want to get this guy out of there. It matters. People need to be volunteering. If they can go down, you know, over the border to Oregon or Nevada or other swing states or phoning Ohio, that's what they should be doing. So the tangible results, they matter, and they matter a lot. On the other hand, what we don't see are the intangible results. And so it may be that you canvass and you're knocking on the doors and you have a conversation with somebody, and you give him the phone number of Sierra Club or MoveOn.org's website or the local Democratic Party, whatever it is, something, you know, Snow Coalition, something to connect up with. And they get involved. And they stay involved. And then down 5 years from now, who knows what they're doing, or 3 years or 1 year. So I think part of the, I mean, I was literally, we had a recently that Seattle night out where they have the block parties, and one of the people in my block's mother was working with Citizen Action, and she'd never really volunteered before, and she helped beat back the privatization of Premier Blue Cross in our state, you know, with thousands of other people. that's really consequential. And I don't know what it was, who got her involved, and I don't know what role she played other than she said you spent a lot of hours doing whatever needed to be done. But you add that up, and what you recognize is that the payback sounds an odd term because it's our sort of market economy dominating everything. But for lack of a better word, the result, the fruits, it's not always linear. You don't always know when something that you do or somebody you bring in will in fact end up paying back down the line and having a major impact. And that's one of the certainly critical lessons of hope.
One of the themes that you return to in all your books is the concept of the citizen. And it seems, I get the impression that you see the citizen as the driving force for our solutions.
Well, I do, because they don't simply happen. If you say that you hope that history will muddle through, well, maybe it will and maybe it won't, but there's some pretty greedy powers out there that are going to make sure that as it muddles through, it gets defined in a certain way. I mean, I remember years and years ago before Boeing merged with whatever it was, what did Boeing take over? McDonnell Douglas, I guess. Yeah. You know, so it was a smaller company. They still had more people on staff lobbying in D.C. than the combined staff of our congressional delegation and our Senate delegation combined, Republicans and Democrats both. So you know, the Boeings of the world are going to get theirs. The question is, what's going to be left for the rest of us? And that has to be ordinary citizens. And it has to be ordinary citizens acting consciously and saying, well, what kind of world do we want? And again, you know, you don't always see the results. Let me go back to that theme in one of the stories from the book that to me is, you know, if I was going to say this absolutely central moment, if there were one essay that I couldn't live without, it's the one by Vlachov Havel. And why is that? Because what Havel does is he describes, it was an essay written in 1986, therefore 3 years before the dictatorships of Eastern Europe fell. He was writing under a communist dictatorship. And what happens is he was describing the growth of the dissident movements. And he started talking about there's a band called Plastic People of the Universe that was very influenced. It was a Czech band that grew up started in the late 60s. It was influenced by Frank Zappa. It was influenced by the Velvet Underground. I mean, it was that international stream of rock and roll bouncing across the world. And, you know, they were listening, and they started making it themselves. And it was a band that the authorities did not like. The words that they used is they were, quote, morbid and, quote, not socially constructive. And they harassed them, and they withdrew the sort of cards that would allow them to play their gigs and play their gigs for money, their musicians' union cards. And they prevented them from having venues. And the band kept playing. They would, like, just, it would be, I guess it was sort of like underground raves or something. They would pass the word, and people would assemble at some vacant warehouse, and the band would play a gig. And this is over a number of years that, you know, sort of kept escalating. And eventually they started trying them and, you know, to throw them in jail. And at that point, Havel formed a defense committee of sort of slightly older, slightly more respectable folks. And what was interesting is that that defense committee began evolving into the organization and the networks that would later become Charter 77, which is the pivotal democracy group. But along the way, the fruits were never very clear because a lot of times what they would do wouldn't seem to have a measurable effect. And so there was one point that Havel was talking about. He was saying there was a petition that they were circulating to free some political prisoners. And it was a very mild petition. They were sort of like pleading with the authorities to amnesty them, not even saying, this is outrageous, how dare they jail them. And they got mocked by it. The novelist Milan Kundera, in one of his books, sort of mocked that very specific petition and said, well, they're just trying to get attention. It's not going to do any good. If they really wanted to do something, they would feed the families of the prisoners or give them some support, but not make this sort of public statement that's going to be completely futile. And Havel was sort of reflecting on that, and he says, you know, some level, Kundera's right. It didn't free anybody. It failed. He said, but on another level, Kundera's completely wrong. Because the people who, when they got out of jail, they said that because of our actions, they felt like their actions and their costs and the risks and the sacrifices had some meaning. So that, you know, they didn't feel alone. Part of what just chews us up and grinds us down is the sense that we're alone and isolated. Our society will always make us so. These people did not feel that they were alone. They felt they were part of a community. He said, and not only that, but the people we drew in the effort to get these people out of jail, they're now still active. And things are breaking out all over the place. And there's dissident theater that would have been shut down 5 years ago, and dissident music, and people are preaching from the pulpits. And he said the amount of dissent now is just amazing, and you can see the cracks in the regime. And all of that is from the people who came in and these seemingly futile efforts. And I love this. If there's any moment in the impossible will take a little while that seems key, it's that discussion, because he's writing looking over the horizon. It's still a dictatorship. By everybody's judgment, it's still going to stay one. But Havel sees that if you build and you build and you build, after a while, you have enough infrastructure that even a dictatorship can't stand. And so, to me, it's such a powerful argument and such a powerful piece for looking at the way that the effects of what we do can never completely be predicted.
In your introduction to the book, you wrote that responses to your previous books had exposed a troubling divide between secular and religious readers. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because I think it's a sort of, well, it's a split in our culture. It's also certainly a split in the left where people, I remember some, I mean, it was actually kind of funny because it was like in Indiana, Muncie, Indiana, you know, middle down America, where you would sort of think that's all kind of, you know, Bible belty. But there were some young women in, this is with Soul of a Citizen, in a class that was using the book, that were just like mortally offended that some of the characters in the book who were doing very courageous social justice things were like, one of them was a, you know, was a very strong Catholic. And, you know, that was part of her being. That was part of, she was a Latina woman from San Antonio. That's what she grew up in. She molded that for her social justice vision. And she was just like, you know, absolutely, you know, how could he talk about this stuff? And, I mean, I think I sort of appeased her because we ended up going off in a discussion of Amsterdam and its drug laws. So it was, you know, I think it became clear I wasn't a Bible belter and talking about the cafes I'd visited and the coffee houses. But the point was, there was just, you know, it struck me, it was just this suspicion that said, you know, somebody who offers, who acts from a sort of explicit framework of religious faith are automatically suspect. And I just think it's such a dangerous, how to describe it? It's a dangerous blindness to the complexity of human metaphors, really, because, I'm coming at it from that side because, you know, certainly the listeners here are much more likely to be in that camp than likely to be in the sort of fundamentalist who says, you know, how dare you say that anybody can do anything without Christ? But there is a sort of reciprocal blindness that really does say, you know, these people must be just kind of delusional. And yet, you know, if you look at some of the most powerful social justice activists around, or Cornel West or Marion Wright Edelman, I mean, these are people who come from an explicit theological background, and it's extremely sophisticated. It's not the big man in the, well, certainly not the big white man in the sky, and it's not the big man in the sky with a beard, but it's this notion and this use of these metaphors, which in their case happen to be Christian, about the forces that are connection to the forces that move the universe. And it's a way that allows them and, you know, millions of other people to keep going in very, very difficult circumstances acting for justice. You know, where you hear Tutu talking about, you know, God has a sense of humor to pick South Africa as a country to be a beacon for the world with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I mean, Tutu is not somebody of simplistic beliefs. I mean, he understands, you know, the evil in the world, including that created by our president, and he's been up against just the most reprehensible regimes. But he also uses this framework, and I'm not saying that all of us have to adopt the same metaphors, but this framework that says there is this force out there that will turn and twist things in surprising ways that offer hope. Now, Howard Zinn, who is Jewish in background but pretty secular, talks about the unexpected turnings of history in one of his essay. I think they're basically making the same point. So one of the things that I think will be useful here is just people putting some of the different metaphors and explanations side by side and recognizing that people are really struggling for some kind of both common vision of justice, but also a kind of common vision of what moves the world and therefore what connects us to something larger. Because I do actually think that if we just feel like there's nothing but ourselves, it is hard to go on. Now, a lot of us can go on. I mean, I remember the Hazel Wolf I wrote about in my last In Soul of a Citizen, who died at 101 years old, lived here in the Northwest, and was, you know, very, she said, you know, I grew up an atheist. That was just, you know, that was my religious faith. But she talks about going out into the Cascades or kayaking on the Sound, and, you know, she gets pretty almost mystical, and it's, you know, you're talking about something larger than yourself, either way. And I think that's important because, again, you go back to the theme of isolation versus community. If we're isolated, if it's only us lifting the burden of everything, we probably are going to burn out. If we're part of something larger that in some sense will continue after us, preceded us, that gives us a sense that we can do our part and carry things forward. I mean, the image that I use was the notion of rolling the rock up the hill, the sort of, I guess, the Sisyphus metaphor. And I thought, well, you know, we're never probably going to get to the top of the hill, but maybe we can help get it to another plateau, to a higher plateau. And I think that, you know, the people who talk about feeling lifted by God, I think that's what they're talking about. I did a workshop recently with a couple amazing civil, you know, longtime civil rights activists dating back from the 60s. One of them actually had this just horrible experience where somebody levied a shotgun at her. This is in Mississippi. She was black. This white activist pulled her back out of the way, and the guy killed him. The store owner killed the white activist. This woman named Ruby Sales, who's been a long activist since then. And, you know, when she's talking about religious faith, it's, again, it's not a simplistic notion. It's a notion, though, that says there is this force that's out there that we can tap into. So, to me, we can name it lots of different ways. But it's useful to understand that we're not just these sort of, like, isolated bits of matter on the earth. And that knowing that can help us keep on.
For those of you just tuning in, we are talking with writer Paul Loeb. He is editor of the new book, The Impossible Will Take a Little While, A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear. You include in your introduction to the book a really nice quote, speaking of isolation, "Nothing cripples the will like isolation." And I think a lot of us often feel that when we are wrestling with the different problems that strike us, that we get a sense that we're the only one that really cares about this or is being affected by it. And it's often a great shock on those moments when the media does actually deliver information to us that we can use, that we find out, oh my gosh, there's other people that are working on that same thing.
Yeah, I think that's, again, if we go back to the cynicism, part of what happens is that we're told that there's so many fewer people out there than there really are. Again, Howard Zinn makes this point very eloquently. And he says, you know, everywhere you go, there are these people. And there are these people acting for justice. And we don't see it because it doesn't make the front page. I mean, I remember, this was on the lead up to the Iraq War, I got an email from somebody who said, yeah, we're organizing here in Everett and we're having a vigil on, I think Hewitt, the Major Avenue, or Colby, the Major Avenue in Everett. And, you know, people are really responding. And I'm thinking, geez, my best friend, who I actually wrote about in Soul of a Citizen, grew up in Everett, and his dad was a Lutheran preacher who basically pretty well got driven out of town for speaking out against the Vietnam War and for integrating the Elks Club. And I thought, you know, Everett's really, you know, let alone going back to the days of the massacre, the Wobblies, I thought, it's not that Everett's completely changed, but the idea that, you know, in places like Everett, not just here in Seattle or not just Capitol Hill, Seattle or something like that, that you actually have these people acting. And I was getting emails from just small towns all over the country, and that's the invisible network that you don't necessarily see. So to be able to know that is to feel supported, recognizing that there are other people out there. And again, that community, I mean, there's an amazing piece near the end of the book. Terry Tempest Williams, a wonderful environmental writer from Utah, it was a piece that was called The Clan of One-Breasted Women that was, I remember about, gosh, almost 18 years ago. I was right after it was my second book on the peace movement came out, and I was traveling around, and peace activists were sort of circulating faded Xeroxes of it, because, of course, it was before any online technologies. And it was about the decimation, literally, of her family as nuclear downwinders, where just everywhere they were exposed to the nuclear tests that had occurred in the 50s, and just riddled with cancer. I mean, mother, grandmother, sister, aunt, and these were sort of Mormon women who didn't smoke, didn't drink, I mean, I have some critiques of Mormons, but they tend to be pretty healthy, actually, in terms of those things. And yet, you know, here they are, just riddled with cancer. And so she's was describing at one point there were a civil disobedience in the Nevada desert on the test site that she was part of. And afterwards, they sort of dumped them kind of in the middle on the edge of town, sort of, you know, in isolation. And they said, you know, they didn't realize that we were home. You know, we had a community. We have a community of each other. We had a community of place. And that sense of having other people with you, it's so powerful. And also, again, you know, the example of courage. I mean, one of the chapters or sections in The Impossible Will Take a Little While is, I call it Courage is Contagious, because we don't always know the examples of courage. I mean, I actually use a story of Terry's in there where she was in Washington, D.C. Again, it was one of the protests right on the eve of the war. It was a Code Pink rally where they were being blocked off from, I guess it was going towards the White House. And there was a cop who just sort of, African American cop was kind of standing there in the way. And all of a sudden, this woman who was in the group started singing. And she was singing, I think she was singing We Shall Overcome. Either that or all we're saying is Give Peace a Chance. I can't remember which, but just like looking at him directly with the sense that reminding him that he would only be where he is because of these citizen movements. And people start singing, she's looking at him, and he just sort of moved aside. And the group went through. It's like this wonderful moment where it was actually a documentary on nonviolence, but I've got some wonderful sections in The Impossible Will Take a Little While by the authors of it. It was when they were overthrowing Milosevic, when at a certain point they were converging, hundreds of thousands of people converging on the Capitol, and Milosevic had the trucks and the army trucks and buses like blocking the road so they couldn't get there. And there's this video of this mayor in his jogging suit, kind of a little bit overweight, from one of the towns around, and they're negotiating with the troops. And the troops say, well, we got it. We have orders to stay here and put this here. And they say, well, okay, we understand that. But supposing we moved the bus out of the way, would that be a problem with you? And the soldiers caucus said, no, that wouldn't be a problem with us. You can do that. And so they moved the bus out of the way, and then they continue with their tractors and their trucks and everything else converging on the Capitol to overthrow Milosevic. And again, it's one of these moments of courage leaping and also sort of imagination, which is another part of it. And one of the essays that I sort of, well, not an essay, actually, it's a story that I went back and forth on. Well, I knew I always wanted to include it, but I sort of didn't know, sort of like you're waiting for permission from I don't know who to say, yes, you can do it. So I asked my wife, Rebecca, you know, should I do it? And I asked my friend who was editing it. I asked a bunch of people, like, is it okay for this piece to be in this book? And it's this amazing story by Sherman Alexie from his latest book. It's a story called Do Not Go Gentle. And what it starts with a family at actually Children's Hospital with their kid in a coma, and actually mirrored Sherman's own experience. His first child was sort of hovering between life and death for a number of weeks and then pulled through and is pretty healthy now. But they're there and they're just talking about the hope rising and falling of these people hanging out with their kids. And at one point, he said he just didn't know what to do, so he thought he would get a toy for the child, even though the child was unconscious. He said, so he went to the store. I thought it was a toy store. It was called Toys in Babeland. And he said, I walked in and I realized it wasn't that kind of a toy store. It was a sex toy store. And he said, I didn't know what to do. I mean, I'm not a prude, but I mean, some of these devices, I didn't even know where they fit and where you would put them or what you would do with them. And so he ends up kind of looking around, and he ends up getting this 15-inch, my wife calls it the chocolate dildo story, chocolate dildo called Chocolate Thunder, and takes it back, and they start like waving it over this kid and beating it on a drum and vibrating it around, and the kid comes back to life. And it's just this amazing moment of wrestling with hope. And I thought, well, yes, I have to have this in the book, of course, because you have to be able to leave room for the unpredictable and the inspired and the creative, and that which is just completely turn everything upside down. And that's part of what hope and persistence are about. So even though it wasn't an explicitly, I mean, it talks in passing about what it means to be an Indian and, you know, and have less money than, you know, whole family than one little tiny nook of this hospital room costs. But it's about a sort of deeper kind of politics at its root. And to me, it was a wonderful story, and I was just so happy to be able to put it into The Impossible Will Take a Little While, into the book.
So how did you break into categories or sections the different stories?
Well, I thought about the themes that I wanted to sort of elaborate on, and so there's themes of possibility when I started out to, and there's themes of people in dark times. I mean, with Havel and Mandela writing from the prison in Robben Island, where they're literally trying to isolate them again, which is what they do, and so they no newspapers are allowed, and yet there will be a guard periodically will wrap a sandwich in a newspaper, or they'll see it over the shoulder, and they'll write on tiny bits of toilet paper and pass it cell by cell. So that was about those, you know, the darkest moments. And there's another chapter called Everyday Grace, just about how you... I started open with a Wendell Berry poem. There's some amazing poems in the book that I just kind of gathered from some of my favorite poem, and an Antonio Machado poem where he talks about bees making honey from your failures and kind of sort of resurrecting hope every moment. And it's just, you know, when you look outside in the world and you... Kaiser Wolf's concept of just, you know, going out hiking, going into the Cascades, drawing on just the richness of that natural world. And then a section on imagination, and I start with an amazing Neruda story about a kind of toy sheep being passed by an invisible hand through a fence hole when he was a kid, and he's giving a pine cone, and he says, you know, the stories that, what's his phrase, you know, the gifts of love from the people who know you are powerful, but the gifts of love from somebody who doesn't know you, who's responding simply because you're a human being, that those are even more powerful, and those are the heart of his kind of radical vision throughout his life. So just that imagination is another story of Susan Griffin, the wonderful feminist nature writer, talks about this moment of during World War II, where there was a surrealist poet named Robert Desnos, and they were taking people off. They was in the camps, and they were taking people off to be killed. And he starts reading people's palms and saying, oh, you're going to have a very long lifeline. You're going to have, you know, many children. You lived many years. And they're thinking, you know, I'm going to be dead in an hour. But he starts doing it. People start kind of fascinating drawing, and the guards get interested. Well, can you read my palm? And they actually turn around and take that particular truckload of people back, and they don't get killed, even though Desnos himself does not survive. He dies of typhus before the war ends. But it's again, she writes about that and juxtaposes it to these photos of these Mexican communists in the 30s, and just the sort of the hope in their faces and that idealism of possibility, even in a very harsh world, and how you live in and make radical change in a world where the sort of grand systems have collapsed. So looking again at creativity, Sherman's piece is in there as well. Again, the notion of courage and just these moments. I think I mentioned this wonderful Unitarian minister, who she starts with this story of a Native American high school basketball team that's getting just really these racist responses and comments at a game that they're playing, I think in South Dakota. And this young freshman ends up taking like her kind of warm-up jacket, making it into a sort of a prayer shawl and doing this amazing dance and just like silences everybody. And then how that story travels and somebody else starts speaking out from that story. So that sense, you know, another section I use is a wonderful Arundhati Roy piece about September 11th that I just always really liked. And I go from there to, say, Ariel Dorfman, this wonderful Chilean writer, who's reflecting on the hope of the Salvador Allende movement and the socialist democracy they tried to build, and then Pinochet and the U.S. coup and smashing it, and just trying to understand what hope still persists from that time. So looking at some of those global issues, there's a great Bill McKibben piece about an amazing city in Brazil, Curitiba, where they just literally have transformed like the downtowns. Now it's this pedestrian area, and they've got these buses on these designated corridors, and instead of doing sort of flood control with channels and concrete, they have these grassy areas that periodically will just flood, but it means that the city is like 10 times as green as it used to be. And this is a pretty poor city where all of a sudden this very, very tangible concrete signs of hope in an environmental context that's often pretty bleak. And then there's another section called Radical Dignity, just about the what it means to stand up, and you're standing up for yourself, and you're standing up for... There's a story that just knocks me out about this prisoner in Louisiana who, I mean, he killed a man when he was very young in a drugstore robbery, and he's been in there a long time and was on death row for a long time. And at one point, they were selling pardons, they were selling with money or sex from prisoners' wives and stuff. And he could have bought his way out. It took about $15,000, and he'd gotten married, and his wife had the money, and he just decided that he couldn't. He was the guy who founded the amazing award-winning prison newspaper called The Angolite. And he just couldn't, and now he's still in there 8 years later. He brought the governor and the pardons board people are both in jail, in part because of his blowing the whistle. But he's also still in there. And so what does it mean to do something with a huge cost because you're standing up for that kind of cost? And you're standing up for what's right no matter what. And then there's a section just talking about letting go of hope, because sometimes you have to act even if it just seems completely bleak. And if it just doesn't matter, no matter what is going to happen. I use this phrase and quote from Mandelstam, this widow of the poet Ossip Mandelstam, who died in the Soviet gulag. And he says, you know, sometimes you just have to scream. It's the only human response. You know, and silence is a real crime against humanity. So that sometimes we're speaking out just for our dignity, just for sort of who we are. And I think it's important because there are those moments where it just doesn't look like you're going to win. And you act and you just say, well, I'm doing this to look myself in the mirror. Cornel West's piece is in that section. You just look myself in the mirror as a human being. And then you never know what's going to happen. And so, you know, that's powerful. And then I end actually with it's a phrase from Alice Walker's amazing essay called Only Justice Will Stop a Curse, where she looks into the heart of, I guess, bitterness. And there's a point where this is an essay that first part of it came from the anti-nuclear movement. And she was saying, you know, maybe these people, these greedy men who run the world, maybe they just have gotten it so messed up that we should just let the whole world blow up, you know, save other planets from our fate, from our greed. And, you know, it's that very dark moment. She quotes a Zora Neale Hurston poem of just this bitter, bitter curse against your enemies, where you just say, let them rot, let their womb shrivel up, let their bodies be torn with pain, that their children suffer. I mean, just go to that dark sense of vengeance. And I don't know about you, but everybody I know, including myself, certainly goes through the moments where you just feel like, you know, I just want them to suffer. I want vengeance. And it isn't, I mean, it's got its uses, I suppose, but it's got its limits as well. And so she just goes into that really bleak place and then pulls out from it and then says, okay, but let's see what keeps us going. And this is a world that has fresh peaches in it and has human generosity and is human. And she talks about this moment where she was, there was always in the heart of the civil rights movement, resenting this one very blonde, Aryan-looking guy from Minnesota who was down there just because he could walk anywhere. And he wasn't subject to the same kinds of abuses. And one day there was this very lonely, dangerous vigil where they didn't know whether someone's going to snatch him away. And they heard this sort of whistling of this sort of awkward whistling of this freedom song. And it's this blonde guy from Minnesota who joined them and just coming up to add a little bit of protection because it was harder and the cost was greater to kill a white person than a black person. And, you know, she's saying, you know, she still rides off that moment 35, 40 years ago of that human generosity. And Tutu's in that section, and this wonderful, amazing story from the Middle East where it's called the Geneva Court Peace Plan, where this group of Arabs and Israeli, were Palestinians and Israelis, were meeting secretly for a couple of years to try and actually create a peace plan. And they just list the people who are in there. It's amazing. It was like, so you've got the cousin of the Hamas leader. This is before the Hamas leader was killed. You've got the person from the Tanzim, this Palestinian militia, guerrilla group. You've got the former Israeli general in charge of Gaza. You've got the major person in the Israeli Secret Service, the Shin Bet. I mean, you've got, you know, it's major, major players on both sides, each of which participated in the wars that made each other the enemy, sitting down and saying, okay, what do we do to actually move forward? What would a peace plan that actually talked about all the really most difficult issues, like who owns Jerusalem and who owns the Temple Mount and all of that, and doing it, and each side giving up something. And it's an amazing document. It's an even more amazing process. And of course, you know, Sharon, you know, completely dismissed it. But it's there now as a force, because they actually have been distributing it to everybody in Israel and everybody on the West Bank. And it's a force to build a dialogue from. And I thought, you know, what a amazingly radical, hopeful action, you know, to sit down with somebody who you can say, yeah, their father killed my brother. You know, it was literally true in this case. My father killed some of their cousins. You know, where you have this history and yet bridge it. So, you know, without, again, I mean, you can talk about forgiveness in a way that, or compassion in a way that sounds really simplistic and naive and sentimental, but these weren't those kinds of essays. These are essays saying, let's actually look into this, you know, really hardest situation. They're Tutu talking about going to Rwanda and saying, you know, there is some hope from our model in South Africa. It didn't lead to perfection. It didn't erase all the issues. But nonetheless, what we do opens a sense of possibility because we were willing to sit down and try and figure out some ways to live together. So that's sort of the arc and curve of the book. It's I like the way I've structured it.
I believe you said early on when we were first talking about this that this is a book that you'd wanted to produce for quite a while.
Yes.
And so in a lot of ways, do you think that our world has gotten to the point where you really had to produce it now?
Where we need it, yes. Yeah. That's a good question. I would say that's probably true. Again, I mean, I've been mulling it over and collecting wonderful pieces, and so it's, I mean, I could say, well, the book took a year to put together, but the book took 30 years. I mean, impossible to take a little while. It took 30 years to put together, really, in some ways, all the time that, you know, that I've been a writer and activist. Yet this time is a time when it is so needed. I mean, when I was circulating, just talking about the book, well, from the very moment that I first started talking with people, say, on my email list, to once, right before it was out, and now that it is, people have said, God, I need this. I need this desperately. I just feel like they're going to steal the election and we're all going to have to move to Canada, and this is the hardest time I've lived through. People keep saying that. I mean, a friend of mine, a wonderful guy, runs the Western State Center in Portland. It's this organizing, consulting sort of training network. And he said, you know, I've seen everything of 30 years be unraveled by this administration. And so my sense is, I mean, and granted, again, I look, as the week that we're talking, the polls look, you know, certainly better than a year ago to get this guy out. But there's a lot of things that can happen. Yeah, there's stolen votes and al-Qaeda attacks and mock al-Qaeda attacks, just a lot. And so it's very easy for people to be fatalistic. I got very angry at a friend of mine who's still supporting Nader, and he said, well, it's not going to matter because they're going to steal it anyway. I said, what are you saying that? I mean, you've got to consider this a contingent world where everything is contingent on our actions. Contingent short-term, contingent long-term. And knowing that, that's hope. Because then your actions actually have a sense of having a possibility of having an impact. But if you feel like it's just out of your control, there's nothing you can do, which is, again, what we've been told, then it does feel hopeless. It does feel so bleak. So, yeah, I think this is a time where people will really are hungry for this book. And then as somebody was saying to me just the other day, they said, you know, actually the real need for hope may actually come even if we get Bush out. Because you think about it. Kerry gets in. He's got probably at least a Republican filibuster in the Congress, possibly, you know, very likely a Republican House or Senate. He's got all the judges they've appointed. And he's not exactly been so courageous in the last decades himself. And people are going to feel like, oh, I tried this. We got him out. And then what's changed? I mean, I remember seeing people peeling away during the Clinton administration, peeling away during the Carter administration. And yet, you know, the other side says this is the moment of possibility. And in fact, if you get enough of a citizen movement going, you can pull people into involvement. You can pull leaders into involvement. And you look at, I mean, the, you know, what makes Kennedy or up on sort of photographs on people, poor people's houses as some, you know, as a kind of, I don't know what, person of mythic stature almost. Well, it wasn't that he was leading the charge on the civil rights movement. It was only, in fact, he was resisting it. It was a pain in the butt for him. I mean, it was only when those people forced the issue onto the agenda that I think he indeed let his better nature respond and rose to the occasion, or at least rose to the occasion partially, and Johnson rose to the occasion more. And so part of the challenge is to see hope in the moments that are clearly have room for despair, but also hope and possibility in those moments that should be moments of possibility, but we're so exhausted and tired from fighting that we sort of give up and we think, okay, now it's taken care of. Anyway, it's fine. I mean, if we get Bush out, we should spend some time celebrating. But then figure out, okay, now there are new possibilities. How do we act on them? And again, I think that requires that sense I mean, it's tricky because I had this conversation, there was an email conversation with Barbara Ehrenreich, who gave just a wonderful quote for the book. She said, "For anyone worn down by years of Bushism, the impossible will take a little while as a bracing double cappuccino." She must have been coming through Seattle. And she was saying, but she was still a little bit wary of the concept of hope. She says, I mean, we don't go to a general going into battle doesn't say, well, geez, I hope we win. You know, so it's not optimism. And Havel makes this distinction. She says, hope is not prognostication. It's not optimism. It's an orientation of the heart. It's an attitude towards the world that says, I'm going to do this no matter what. It's not just saying, gee, I hope things get better. Hope things get better doesn't get us anywhere. But there is a sense of possibility that we seize on. I like, there was a wonderful radical social justice minister, Jim Wallace, who I use in the book, and he says, hope is believing in spite of the evidence and then watching the evidence change and acting in spite of the evidence. So you see what's in front of you. It doesn't look good. You start to act, it changes. That's part of that grounding as well. So again, it goes back to the difficult you do at once. The impossible will take a little while, but it's still doable.
Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
My pleasure.
We have just been talking with Paul Loeb. He is a local writer and author, and in to discuss his latest book, The Impossible Will Take a Little While, A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear. And you can find out more about the book at the website www.theimpossible.org.